some years ago, is this on? Some years ago, I read a scholar asserting that the more probable alternative to Jesus' bodily resurrection was that his body was burned in the cemetery, or the place where they burned bodies outside of Jerusalem.
Yeah. Gehenna.
Was that a widespread, more widespread practice than burial, and does that have any plausibility?
No, that would be an absolute desecration. Even victims of crucifixion were taken down and put in the ground. You certainly did not immolate the body. That was not a Jewish practice at all. It would be seen as desecration of the body, and especially for those who believed in resurrection. No, that's absolutely wasn't a Jewish practice. Now, in fact, in the Old Testament, you hear about those who worship the god Molech that practiced child sacrifice and immolation. This was seen as an absolutely abhorrent practice by Jews to do that to anyone, never mind to a child. So, no, this was not a recognized Jewish practice at all. Yes, ma'am. Microphone's coming.
I hate to be dense, but when you said to the Pope, the bad news is Jesus has a brother, I didn't really understand that.
Well, the Catholics don't believe that Jesus had any physical brothers. They don't believe Mary had other children other than Jesus. They believe they are either cousins of Jesus or children of Joseph by prior marriage, neither of which is what the New Testament says, but that's their belief. Other questions?
Besides the scholarly question about resurrection and so on, do you see any ethical issues that flow from this whole discussion? Any points underneath
yes,
the surface that are also...
I absolutely do, and I hope I did more than hint at that, but I absolutely do. And here's what I would want to say. If a theory does not pass the scratch and sniff test of the vast majority of experts in the field, then there is an ethical responsibility to say so. Even if you want to say, well, I'm the only person, and I'm in a minority of one, but I'm really the only person who's pushing this theory. You need to understand that there are scholars who seek out the media and try to produce results that will, I don't know, enhance their reputation, further their career, sell a lot of books. These sorts of things do happen, unfortunately, and it's an unethical practice. If a theory is so tenuous that the evidence is so shaky, I'm not saying let's not talk about it. I'm fine with talking about it, but what you must not do is get up as an authority figure in your field and say, we have proven beyond reasonable doubt that this is the tomb of Jesus, and anybody who doesn't believe it is just a troglodyte. Well, that's an assertion without evidence, and it's unethical. What decides this issue is the evidence and the interpretation of the evidence. So yes, there's absolutely an ethical issue here. You see, here's why. Christianity is a historical religion, like Judaism, like Islam. It stands or falls on a certain irreducible amount of historical claims. If Christianity was just a philosophy of life, we would not be talking about archaeology, okay? But because it is a historical religion, you have to make your claims based on evidence and a careful interpretation of that evidence. And if your theory stands against the preponderance of evidence and the preponderance of scholars, then you have an obligation to tell whoever you're telling this to that that's the case. And if you don't do that, you're not just eccentric, you're unethical.
The other colleagues of James Tabor at UNCC, especially Loy Witherspoon and other people that have been in their department, how do they take what he says?
Well, I know Loy. I mean, he's been involved with this very church, as a matter of fact. And I have great respect for him. And honestly, he has never gone on record ever since this stuff came out. Now, you need to understand that this is not the first such theory that Dr. Tabor has put forth. He also thought he found the burial place of John the Baptist. There are various of these kinds of theories that he has put forward before in his book, The Jesus Dynasty. And when he wrote that book, this was pre-Talpiot tomb, and he was thinking that Jesus was buried in Galilee, and some medieval rabbi found his bones in Galilee. That's what he says in his book, The Jesus Dynasty. So you need to understand that it's a moving target. The theory keeps changing. And so I honestly don't know what his colleagues think, but if it were me, I would be distressed. The issue is good scholarly judgment.
And how do you understand the similarities and differences in the resurrected body of Jesus? How do you read the New Testament?
Between his body and?
His body as the same and how changed after the resurrection.
Okay. This is a wonderful question. Let's compare what happened to Lazarus and what happened to Jesus, okay? Let's make a comparison and contrast. Lazarus truly dead according to John chapter 11. Jesus raised him from the dead after he was 4 days dead, okay? Now, he went back to a healthy condition of the old body that he had. He did not have what we would call a resurrection body, so he went on to die again. If I were an archaeologist, the one ossuary I would like to find would be Lazarus's, because it would read, died 29 A.D., and then below that it would read, died 43 A.D. This would confuse some people. This would confuse some scholars, to say the least. The difference between that is that Lazarus went back to a state of mortality. Jesus went forward into a state where his body was immune to disease, decay, and death. Immune to suffering, sorrow, and sin. So the reason Paul calls him the first fruits of the resurrection is not because he was the first person ever raised from the dead. It's because he was the first person who ever had a resurrection body, with which he took with him, according to the New Testament, into heaven. So he should be easy to identify in heaven. He's the only one there with a resurrection body.
Can you hear?
Yep.
One question that might be in the room is, in light of the sensationalism that seems to be a collaborative effort between some scholars and some media,
yep,
and this Jerusalem symposium, which seemed to have had the media reeling a little bit and having that one program that aired once and then was pulled at a loss, can you just give us an idea of the lay of the land? Have we entered into a new zone where we can't trust what we thought we could trust? We have to think differently about sifting?
Well, here's what we know. The media wants an audience. The bigger the audience, the better the ratings, the more money they make. And so there are certainly many responsible media persons. But when they hear a sensational claim, if there's a possibility that it could be true, however improbable, if there's a possibility it could be true, it's going to get headlines. Because why? Sensationalism sells. It's the same reason the National Enquirer sells. You know, it's the very same issue here of the lust of Western culture for sensational data of various kinds, not just scholarly data, but we'd like the dirt on this movie star or that movie star, etc. And so there's almost an insatiable desire for this kind of information. So if the culture wasn't driving this, the media wouldn't be giving it to us. So it's not ultimately the media's fault. It's our fault for buying this stuff or paying attention to it or watching it on television. We have a choice about that. I honestly think that there, you know, The problem is the media are not experts in many, if any, of the subjects that they report. Yes, they've been trained in journalistic ethics, but since they don't have the critical evidence to be able to weigh the data, then they have to rely on authorities. Then the question is, what authorities do they go to? The ones that give them a good headline with a buzz, or the ones that are a little more sedate and mundane and say, well, on further review, this is probably not worth the paper it's printed on? Okay. Well, they have a tendency to go with A rather than B because it sells newspapers or magazines or whatever. And, you know, there is a journalistic ethics issue in regard to that, but that's the culture we live in. And here's what really needs to be said. We are in a postmodern situation where it's acceptable in our culture to trash Christianity in various contexts. That's where we are now. We are in what is called, widely called, the post-Christian era of American history. And there's more truth than poetry to that. You know, those of us who live in the Bible Belt have not yet gotten the full impact of that, but it's absolutely true, especially in large media markets. And so, you know, now people like Christopher Hitchens or Mr. Dawkins from Oxford can write books as angry atheists, simply trying to say Christianity is the opium of the people and it has no historical credibility whatsoever, and it will actually not be simply placed on the shelf as merely eccentric. It will actually be entertained as a viable option intellectually for our culture to embrace. That's kind of where we are. 30 years ago, those books would have been seen as novel curiosities, and they would not have become bestsellers on the New York Times bestseller list. But that's where we are culturally now, and we need to be aware of that as Christian persons.
There were two disciples that ran to the tomb.
Yes.
One we know is Peter.
Yes.
And the other was the beloved disciple. Who was that?
Well, in my view, the beloved disciple was Lazarus. That would be my opinion. And the reason I think that is that in John chapter 11, when we have the phrase, the one whom Jesus loves, it is very specifically applied to the person of Lazarus. The sisters of Lazarus send the plea to Jesus saying, Lord, the one whom you love is ill. And in the very same verse, he's identified as Lazarus. Now, if you were to hear that gospel in an oral culture, that would be the trigger phrase for interpreting what the beloved disciple phrase in John 12 and John 13, John 14, John 19, John 21 means. The first reference told you who it was. Thereafter, when you hear that phrase, you assume it's referring to the same person. That's the way it works in an oral culture. So in my view, I think the beloved disciple is an eyewitness Judean disciple, namely Lazarus. But that's a story for another day. All right. Thank you very much. I have one story to tell you before we close. I was preaching in England at Easter some years ago, and it was a little pithead Methodist chapel in the middle of nowhere. And I got off the bus, and the chapel steward, who sort of ran the chapel, ran down to me, and he was all flummoxed, and he said, I must ask you something. And I said, go ahead, shoot. He said, no, nothing so drastic as shooting. I said, well, go ahead. You know, he said, you do believe in the resurrection, don't you? And I said, yes, that's what I'm here to preach. It's Easter Sunday morning. He said, I'm ever so relieved. The chap we had at last Easter didn't. Dear friends, Jesus is alive and well, and someday is coming to a theater near you in the flesh. Get ready.
Thank you. You're all welcome to stay for a little while to interact with each other and with Dr. Witherington, and there's some refreshments over here. Thank you.